Blog Talk Radio.
Experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator, and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off. Joining Vito and me tonight to co-host is Dean Beers. Dean and his wife Karen are CrimeWire consultants and have provided expert commentary in a number of stories featured here on CrimeWire. Dean and Karen own and operate the highly regarded firm Associates in Forensic Investigations based in Colorado. Dean, have you signed on yet? He hasn't shown up yet here. We are going to devote the entire hour to a murder case that dates back to April 4th, 1951. On that date, Clarence Pellett was murdered by a 19-year-old hitchhiker named Frank Dryman. Mr. Pellett died from a gunshot wound. His body was discovered on a roadside in Montana. His killer fled to Canada, where he was later arrested. After several trials and court appeals, Frank Dryman was convicted and sentenced to life in prison, then paroled in 1969 after serving just 15 years of his sentence. Less than 2 years after his parole, Frank Dryman was listed by the Montana Department of Corrections as absconded. He had simply disappeared. He walked away from parole. Last year, Frank Dryman was arrested after he was found living in Arizona, where he was operating a wedding chapel and using the name Victor Houston. Instrumental in the arrest of Frank Dryman, a.k.a. Victor Houston, was the grandson of Clarence Pellett, Dr. Clem Pellett. Tonight, Dr. Clem Pellett joins us to share his story of how he sought justice for his grandfather. Also joining us is Dorothy Lascance, Dr. Pellett's cousin and granddaughter of Clarence Pellett. We will also hear from two of the private investigators hired by Dr. Pellett to help him locate the whereabouts of his grandfather's killer. And later we will hear from Patricia Lindholm, who knew Frank Dryman as Victor Houston. Let's start by going right out to Clem Pellett. And Clem, good evening. Thank you for joining us here and going to share this very interesting story with our listeners across the country. So why don't you just tell us a little about your family, and then we'll get into your grandfather. So tell us a little about
yourself.
Well,
thanks very much. I sure appreciate the opportunity. My grandfather, Clarence C. Pellett, was murdered when he was 59 years old, and it was 2 years before I was born.
Uh-huh.
At the time of his murder, he had 6 children and 16 grandchildren, a rather large family. And
wow.
He was well known around the Shelby area. He was an oil rigger. And his wife had opened up a small restaurant, really essentially out of their home. and they were just kind of making ends meet. In fact, not too long before the murder, they had just gotten indoor plumbing. He, as by all accounts, because I never met this man, he was murdered 2 years before I was born. By all accounts, he was very affable, quite a talker, as a matter of fact, and he was as round as he, you know, as tall as he was round. His name is Shorty, and he was also called CC.
Uh-huh. And so you didn't know him growing up, obviously. He was killed 2 years beforehand. Is your cousin Dorothy here on the line yet? Dorothy,
I am.
Dorothy,
oh,
good evening.
Good evening.
Did you know your grandfather? Did you get to interact with him?
Yes, I did. I was turned six the month after he was murdered, so I do have memories of my grandfather. Not as much as some of my older cousins, but yes, and Clem is right. They was called Shorty, and he was about as round as he was tall. Very gentle person, you know, loved his grandchildren, played with us a lot, and then he was gone.
Okay. What do you remember of his death? Again, you were around 6 years of age. Do you remember the arrest of Frank Dryman, his killer?
Yes. You know, I don't remember. Yes, I do, I guess. My father was all the brothers were extremely torn up with this, and I just remember my father coming home, talking about the death of his father and crying, and there was a lot of turmoil in the family and the sense of relief when he was picked up because he was found frozen in a field after he was shot, and school kids found him. Or they took buses out to look for him, and then an old sheep herder actually found his body. So there was a lot of sadness and turmoil in the family and a lot of relief when Dryman was captured just a few days afterwards.
So what about the impact in the community? How did people handle his murder and then the arrest?
You know, Clem could probably tell you more about that because he's done a lot of research in that area. I just remember the devastation that the family, the personal devastation the family had, and the whole community was devastated. But I was really too young to remember a lot about what happened in the community other than it was a big, big thing because of the violence involved in the lack of motive, but Clem can explain a lot more about that than I could as being a
child. Okay, let me frame the question here. Clem, how did you learn of your grandfather's murder?
Well, first, just a smidge of background is that, you know, again, I never met my grandfather, and a sign of the turmoil in the family was that not too long after my grandfather's murder, my grandmother, whom I never met either, remarried, and my father, who was the youngest of his children, disowned the family. And so I grew up never meeting the Pellets or knowing anything about the Pellets. But how I found out about it, again, you know, when I was 56 years old in 2009, my mother sustained a stroke, and she lived in Arizona. And so then my wife and I went down, and we cleaned out her place, and we found a box of, you know, memories, keepsakes, and we didn't have time to look at them then, so we shipped them home to here in Bellevue, Washington. About a month later, as I always like to say, I was watching the Mariners, and they're no better then than they are now, and I finally gave up on them, and I started looking through this box, and about an hour into it, I found a series of newspaper articles that were very neatly folded, but definitely separated from the scrapbooks and everything, And I started unfolding them, and I would unfold them and read the headlines, and they talked about Frank Drymon, a name I didn't even know at the time, and how he had been sentenced to hang, and how he had had a dream about where you could find the weapon, and then he led him up to where he had buried the weapon just across the border, and miraculously found the weapon. So that perked my interest, and then I went to the internet, found out that he was an absconder, and then that started about a 9-month search of all the newspapers of the time, I got a lot of articles, hundreds of pages of articles about it. It was a very big case. It even commanded national attention at the time. Even Walter Winchell, who was a famous radio announcer.
Mm-hmm.
Made mention of it because over that there was a 4-year period, and it was two additional trials. He was first sentenced immediately. He was found the day after the murder. He confessed a week after the murder, and he was sentenced to hang less than 2 months after the murder. And then a lawyer who had strong ties to the Communist Party. Remember, this was the McCarthy era and the Red Scare, but people who had ties to the Communist Party, and he was one of them, decided that they would take this and make this a case against capital punishment. And so he was a very, very successful. He had a very sympathetic Montana Supreme Court. He went to the Supreme Court after each of the trials. Remember, there were two additional trials, both of which he was sentenced to hang. And he went to the Montana Supreme Court 4 times over that 4-year period, won every appeal. And then finally, again, the third trial, in 1955, he was sentenced to life in prison.
And how long did he serve before he was paroled again? Was it 15 years, I said?
15 years, that's correct. In 19, I guess another twist to this would be, as I found out from Dorothy after we met, my father, even though he disowned the family, had gone to each one of the parole hearings. He had a total of 7 parole hearings over that 15-year period. And he was the only member of the Pellett family to go to the parole hearings and to object to his parole. My father died in 1968, in January of 1968. Drymon's final parole hearing was 10 months later, in November of 1968, and he was paroled, and as the records state, partly because no one was there to object. And then, as you said in your intro, then about 18 months later, he vanished. And that, and then he was gone. So nobody knew where he was, and that was all of that.
What did you know of Drymon's background around the time of the murder? What did he do for work?
What I found out is that he went by several names. He went by Frank Drymon and Frank Valentine at the time. He went by those two names. At the age of 16, he robbed a liquor store. He went before the judge, and he was given a choice. He could either go to jail and juvenile detention, or he could join the military. He was ordered to join the Marines, but the Marines kind of scared him, and so he joined the Navy. And then the Navy, he only served about 10 months in the Navy, and the Navy didn't want any more to do with him, and so they drummed him out. Then about 3 months later, he joined the Air Force under the name Drymon. So under the name Valentine, he joined the Navy. Under the name Drymon, he joined the Air Force. Well, he quickly decided that the Air Force wasn't for him either, and so he went AWOL. And they picked him up in California. He was in the brig for about 3 months, and then the Washington, D.C., of course, she didn't have computers at the time, so Washington, D.C. finally figured out via fingerprints that these two were the same guys, and they just let him out and said that, you know, they just wanted to wash their hands of him. He was kind of a ne'er-do-well. And then he started just roaming the country hitchhiking, and he had started from Reno, Nevada, 2 days before the murder, so on April 2nd, 1951. But he was only dressed in for California weather. But when he hit Montana on April 4th, a huge storm was coming down from Canada, and the wind was blowing, the snow was blowing sideways, and all he had on was just a very light coat, and he had a shaving kit, and that was it for luggage. My grandfather picked him up around dusk and drove about 20 miles north towards Canada and started to turn east, and Dryman said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to let you out here." And he said, "No, you're not, old man. You're not going to let me back out in the cold." And then he drew the gun on him because he was carrying a .45 as a shoulder holster, in a shoulder holster. And he had him drive a bit further. He said, you get out of the car. And my grandfather got out of the car, and he begged for his life, went to his knees and begged for his life, saying, "I'm a father, I'm a grandfather, I have a big family." And Dryman simply laughed, by his own admission. And my grandfather turned and started to run. But remember his stature, he wasn't going to sprint away. And Dryman missed him with the first shot. And then in Dryman's words, he said, "I dropped him with the second shot. And I ran up," and he emptied the rest of the gun into his back. And when they found the body, because Dryman had used steel-jacketed bullets, the bullets had been buried in the ground just short of a foot, right beneath the body, so it was very close range. So it was a brutal murder, and the community, remember, this is Montana, rural Montana, and as Dorothy said, when they found out that my grandfather was missing, then everything stopped. Schools let out, businesses stopped. They even managed to get 3 airplanes up in the air looking for him, and they found him about 24 hours after the murder. And but they were quite outraged by the brutality of the murder. And then once they found Dryman, then they had figured they had done their job. They had been a small community. They had conducted an international manhunt across the border, found their man, found the weapon, got him to confess, and they had him all sentenced to hang with the hanging date June 1st, less than 2 months later.
I want to call on my colleague here, Vito Colucci. Your thoughts on this segment?
Well, it's a very interesting case. What I'd like to ask is, Frank Dryman kills him. Obviously, he takes the vehicle, number one. Am I correct?
Yes. They found the vehicle about 10 o'clock the next morning, just short of the border.
Okay. Now, did he go rifle his pockets? Did he take any money, do you know of? Anything
he
of that
did,
nature?
Yeah, they speculate he took about $30, and he had then wiped the car down. He walked across the border. He walked across the border because he knew the border agents would ask him for registration and things. So he walked across the border in the middle of the night and fell asleep in a lobby on the Canadian side. And again, remember, it was very, very cold. And so, but he knew he didn't want to be caught with the gun. And so he went out the back door of the hotel, and he buried the gun and along with 60 rounds of ammunition, and then piled up some bricks on it. And he just wanted to get rid of the gun.
And how old is Dryman now?
He'd be 79. He was captured at 78, so he'd be 79 now.
Okay. Amazing. You know, Tom, when I started to read this story, it was initially playing out like, okay, no big deal. You know, the guy goes to jail, he's convicted, life in prison, blah, blah, blah. But the way you got to fast forward this 60 years later, and the grandson of Clarence Pellett. I mean, it's just an amazing made-for-TV movie, you know?
Yeah. I heard Dr. Pellett speak at a PI conference in Washington, D.C. he and Sheila Klopper were there to share their thoughts on some aspects of the investigation that we can certainly get into later. I'd like to, maybe at this point, bring Sheila in. How did you get involved with Klemperle?
Hi, good evening, and thank you for having me. I got a phone call from Emily Andrews, who is a young new attorney, and her office is in Redwood City, and she rents from an attorney that I've done work for over the years. And she asked the attorney, who to go to look and to find this guy, and he referred her to me. And so I entered the picture. Dr. Pellet had some substantial information, such as a social security number, and when you start to look for people, that's one of the first things you want to try to get because it separates the person from anybody else. And I subscribe to many different databases around the country with my California license. And I ran the Social Security number through Merlin Information Systems Services in Montana, if you can believe that. And the hit that I got on it was just a one hit, and it had the names Frank Valentine, and it had a name of Victor Houston. And there was an address in Glendale, Arizona, and then there was a P.O. box in Arizona City. And I'm someone who really likes to work in the way of a team, and Patty Shaughnessy is an investigator in Phoenix, and that's my go-to person when I need anything in Arizona. And so I contacted Patty and gave her a little bit of the story and the address and P.O. box. She checked out the address in Glendale, and that was of no benefit. And then she did some other searching on the name of Frank Valentine and Frank Dryman. And ultimately, she referred the case down to Pat Cody, who is a retired police chief that lives closer to Arizona City, and asked me if it would be okay to hire Pat. And I said yes and have him go out and see if he can what he can find out. We'd gotten the physical address from the post office with a postal forwarding. And so that just gave us the physical address, and we had the names of Frank Valentine and Victor Houston associated to this address. And then the other thing ultimately was that Dr. Pellet was able to give us some features such as tattoos to look for on the hands and some other identifying marks, and that all aided in identification of who was now Victor Houston.
Okay. Is Pat Shaughnessy with us? Yes.
Yes. Good evening. How are
good.
You
Hi,
both?
Hi, Patty.
Hey, Patty.
Sheila, you pretty much gave my trade secrets away.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there. There's more you
did.
Go ahead.
No, that's quite... No, it was... usually... You don't get very far with the postal PO's forwarding search. But in this case, we had a lovely postmistress in this tiny little city in Arizona. I hadn't even heard of it before, but Arizona City. So I took a chance and sent down a form that we use that we've modified for our purposes. But anyway, put in the post office box. I put in both names that we knew of, which were Dryman and Valentine, and indicated our actual purpose on that request. And, I just didn't expect much to come back. And lo and behold, within a few days, she faxes me back with this address that we didn't really know who was at that address at the time. But I did a little more research. And speaking of databases, I went to SkipSmasher as one of them, and up came connected kind of with that post office box and was a business called Pink Panther Signs. And later we learned that that was a business that the man who had assumed, taken an alias of Victor Houston. I had checked every conceivable record in Arizona under Valentine and Dryman. No motor vehicles, nothing, not even a lien or anything. So that address from the post office was our key piece of information. And since he was living in Arizona City, that's about an hour from Phoenix, I went ahead and got an okay to use our our colleague out of Casa Grande, Pat Cody, who's a former police chief like yourself, Tom, and he agreed to go do the check him out in person and see if we had the right guy.
Yeah, unfortunately, Pat couldn't join us because he's teaching a criminal justice class tonight, but he sends his regards to everybody.
Oh, good.
Hey, Tom.
Go ahead, Vito.
Tom. Just like to say this so our listeners can understand a little bit. First of all, kudos to the PIs on the show, Sheila and Patty. Great work. Very, very good work. Dr. Clem, you got a good team there that came forward on this year.
Yeah.
And I want to say after being 20 years as a private detective and a ex-cop before that, the listeners need to understand that the search engines that we as private detectives have are not the same that the general public gets when they go online and they think they got all this information and they already call you saying, well, I already paid like $1.82 and I got this and I got that. The search engines we have are top of the line. You have to show your license, obviously. You have sometimes pay a monthly fee, sometimes not. The TLO, which is the new one that I just joined a few months ago, I had to literally give them everything but my youngest son. I had to show all my police department credentials because that's only for cops and ex-cops. So I basically had to show them a mound of material, and whether it's Tracers or Merlin, thank God up to this point we still have these good search engines that are for us. And it allows us to do a lot of things. On the matter of Social Security checks, that varies. There's so many arguments and different scenarios that you hear across the country. I've talked on that at different seminars. You have some of the search engines which will give you a Social Security number as you being what's called the end user, okay? They're giving it to you as the end user. You are not to give that paperwork over to the client or anything of that nature. A lot of them do not give you the social, and I don't really care either way. I just want to locate the person if that's what I'm doing or gather as much information. So I just wanted the listeners to understand the difference in what they do when they paid a couple of dollars online compared to what all these people you're listening tonight to as professionals. And again, ladies, very good job. I love listening to great work like that.
Let me go to Clem. Clem, how much searching did you do before you engaged the services of an investigator?
Well, actually, I started it in April of 2009 and with newspaper articles. And then after I had contacted close to 50 newspapers, and then I started looking at libraries because, again, this is a very big case, and so we ran across some testimony. And part of the testimony, when I say we, my wife and I, and she found his description of his tattoos in the testimony. But and then one thing I really want to make clear is that this search could have been derailed at any point, but it was like a serendipitous event would then insert itself, and the search kept going. And I want to make it also very clear, I was never looking for this man. What I was trying to do is find the story. I was 56 years of this kind of mystery story that we never talked about that separated myself from another family. And all of a sudden, one of those serendipitous events was that I had all this information of how he got into jail, but I had no idea why they let him out. And so I contacted the Montana Parole Board, and they pretty much stonewalled me. And then a month later, we were having dinner. It was during the holiday season, and the family that we were having dinner with had a young daughter, Emily, who had just graduated from law school 2 weeks before, had passed the bar, and she didn't have anything else to do. And so she said, I'll help you. And she did. And then by January of 2009 or 2010, I got information from the parole board. And then another event happened. And that was is that I was diagnosed with kidney cancer. Now, not always a good thing, but what it did allow is that for the 6 weeks that I stayed home over February and part of March, I was able to kind of correlate and collate all of this information because I had nothing but time on my hands. I'd spend 7 or 8 hours a day, and if I were doing my usual profession, I wouldn't have had that. So it just we were kind of touched from above, I think, as we just kept moving from step to step.
Indeed you were. Let me see if Patty Lindholm has come on yet. Patty, are you out there? She hasn't called in yet. It'd be interesting to get her perspective on Dryman as she knew him. The investigation kicks into gear, and so Pat Cody goes out and does some surveillance.
He actually went on one Saturday afternoon after a meeting. He had some extra time, and he drove out to the address that was attached to this post office box. And one other point, the reason that Victor Houston was holding on to this post office box was that he was getting a government pension under the name Frank Valentine. So we had the privilege of funding his being a fugitive over those 38 years. But then he was able to detect these tattoos on the back of his hand. They had been covered over, and much to Pat's credit, he was able to look at those and say, no, those are prison tattoos. Those are, but they were in the right position from the tattoos that we had described. And so I give him an awful lot of credit. Again, had that not happened, he would just walked away and said, well, that's not our guy, and that was it.
All right. Let me see. Has Patty Lindholm called in yet? No? Okay. Vito, your thoughts?
We have Dean here, too. Is Dean on? Or no?
Yeah, I'm here, Vito and Tom.
Why don't we give Dean, what do you think about this case? Interesting, huh?
It is. Hi, Dr. Pellett, and hi,
hey,
and hi, Pat. I saw Dr. Pellett's and Sheila and Pat's presentation at the NALI conference when this, one of the first presentations. This is a very interesting story, and, you know, having done these locates for over 20 years, this was fantastic work that Sheila and Pat did on this, and both Pats in putting this together. I think it's fantastic. I kind of go back to the crime and just curious about the town's reaction to when this took place and he was paroled and escaped. How did they react, and were they able to help in any way with initially trying to find the guy, or was the time just one of those where he was just gone and not found until Sheila and Pat did find him? What's kind of the background of that?
Well, the background of that is that, as I say, in 1968, after my father died, then he was paroled. He was given a special dispensation. Not only was he let out early, but he was also paroled to California. And at the time, the officials, Judge McPherson was one of them, that wrote a stern letter of condemnation of the parole board, that this is too big an area, you're never going to be able to find him. They were quite angry, and also and this is something that Dorothy, you could talk about. I think I've had several phone calls from people who lived in Shelby during that time. Is when they found out that he had been paroled, they were quite scared, because during the court case, he made no bones about that he was going to get even with the people who testified against him. He had made threats against the Pellett family, And so once they heard that he had been paroled, people were on high alert. Do you remember any of that, Dorothy?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. I remember just growing up with, and I think Clem had this message too, never pick up a hitchhiker. That was
ever.
The theme of the family. And then when he was paroled, I still lived in Shelby, as did a number of family members, and I remember being terrified of where he was and would he come back and make good on his threats to kill the rest of us. So having the Pellet name in Shelby at that time was a pretty frightening thing. And my father had died 3 years after Grandpa was murdered, and in part it was heart condition, but the stress of the trials we still think had something to do with his death. So we not only suffered that, but then when he was paroled, my mother was a widow raising three children and, you know, kind of by herself. So it was pretty terrifying for a lot of people in Shelby, the fear, because we didn't know where he went. So, you know, it was a pretty frightening experience, actually, which may seem silly now, but, you know, back then it was a small town and everybody knew where everybody lived and everybody knew whose last name was Pellet.
Yeah, and I don't think it was so silly. That's part of why I asked. I remember Dr. Pellet just kind of expanding on that at the presentation. And I would think that for years the family in the town probably were still afraid, even 40 years later, knowing that he's out there, at least the people that still remembered this, you know, this brutal murder.
You know, that's true, and this may sound silly, but I remember when I got married, it was some sense of relief that I no longer had the Pellet name, just because this man wouldn't be able to track me down because I had a different name.
Wow, that's incredible.
I mean, that runs pretty deep.
Well, let me ask this, Tom. When Dryman was arrested in Arizona, you know, at the wedding chapel, operating the wedding chapel, when the police arrested him, were either of the private detectives there too when he was actually arrested? Because I wanted to see his reaction when he was arrested. Anybody know how? Was he totally surprised that people had found him?
Well, if Pat Limholm, she'd know more about it. I've talked to her quite a bit, and he at first thought it was his son-in-law that turned him in, and he was surprised, but he still felt very, very confident that nothing was going to happen because, after all, it was 38 years, and he had lived such a good life, in his words, Victor Houston, that they just weren't going to do anything to him. So he was pretty confident.
So he was probably just pretty happy on his own that, like you said, he lived all these additional years in his life and enjoyed them that he could have spent in prison.
Yeah.
And he was getting a federal check. Incredible.
Yeah. $300 a month. He was getting a federal check, and in fact his family and they go by Valentine. His family, his younger brother, helped him get more benefits as Frank Valentine, but then his family would send him birthday cards under both Victor Houston and Frank Valentine. In an interview after after he was captured and re-imprisoned, Frank Dryman, it's tough to keep him straight. he thought that was kind of cute that he got birthday cards in both names, and he definitely has no remorse. I mean, there's not even an ounce
of
it.
Well, you know, he covered his tracks very well in Arizona, too. When he actually did get a driver's license, he got it in that alias, Victor Houston. He had changed his date of birth, and at one time his driver's license was a Social Security number, and he had altered that as well. So I think he felt pretty confident that he wasn't going to be found, because he had three different identifiers changed.
Wow.
And his family was helping him
pay
him, too.
I was going to say, he actually had a, another name that he used for who he was somewhat of an artist.
Yes.
And did a lot of sketches. And he's done Girlfriend Love.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Frank Love was.
And that's
what
he had tattooed
name.
On
yeah.
the back of his hand, too.
Was he ever suspected of any criminal activity during these 38 years?
Take it away, Sheila.
I knew this one was coming.
Sheila?
Sheila?
All right, well,
is she there?
Not with us. Yes, I think, Clem, you could probably really...
private investigators, bless their hearts, just kept going because they were just so happy to help out. And he married five times. Two of those wives have disappeared.
One in particular we're concerned about in New Mexico. She's never surfaced. And we're still working on that one. In fact, Dean, I'm hoping Dean will help us on certain aspects of that. And then there's a suspicion of his son-in-law's death might not have been a suicide as was reported.
I recall talking about that one.
Yeah, it's believed that he had his hand in that because he was going to leave his daughter, Kathy, who indeed was at his parole hearing and made quite an appearance, huh, Dr. Clement?
She did make quite an appearance, yeah. She's at the parole hearing. See, the other thing, the way that, okay, remember I was disassociated from my family, and then when all the news hit about this, about 5 days after, thank gosh, Dorothy had the guts to call. And she called, and we just immediately hit it off. We'd never met, and we decided to meet in Shelby a few weeks later. And it was at that family reunion. There were 25 people there, and my wife and my daughter and I had driven up, and we get out of the car, and there's 25 people just waiting to hug you and welcome you into a family. It was quite a scene. And but during that, and we spent a couple of days talking and just getting to know who's who and who belongs to who and how many kids they have. You know, I haven't seen it. You know, I didn't know them before this. But we all decided that we were going to go to his parole hearing, which was going to be a couple of weeks after this reunion, as a family. So rather than, you know, like my dad went on his own, as I found out at this reunion, I didn't know that. And so when I spoke to the parole hearing, other family members did as well. And, you know, as a result of this, I mean, the Pellett family is whole again. So it's on an emotional level, it's quite a feat.
So what's the long-term situation for Dryman right now?
He is up for parole again in May of 2015. He was cited for some parole violations, obviously, not reporting to his move and then having married without permission. But what we didn't mention is when he was captured a few days after Pat Cody recognized the tattoos, he was armed. And he had several weapons on the premises of this small little compound that he used as a wedding chapel. And so it remains to be seen if he'll be charged with, you know, fugitive with a weapon. I don't know.
And he was never...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, he was never arrested. He stayed out of trouble for these years in Arizona. Other than possibly killing ex-wives, did he stay out of trouble? Was he ever arrested under that other name?
Brush with the law is that he got involved in a traffic accident And he fled the scene for obvious reasons. He was afraid that the police were going to be there. But otherwise, yeah, he kept his nose clean. In fact, so clean that there were several sheriffs over the 38 years that he became personal friends with in the town of Arizona City, and he was on search and rescue and security details. He had really inserted himself, and in my opinion, kept himself pretty close to the law just to see what's going on.
Right. And he was a notary public, and
it's a
felon cannot be a notary public.
Right.
So
unbelievable.
So he just covered everything.
Well, and the notaries from Arizona contacted me after all this, and they had introduced a bill with my grandfather's name on it to tighten things up a bit. And as I understand, it did pass. I don't know if my grandfather's name ended up on it, but that's how they introduced it.
Let me ask Sheila and Pat Shaughnessy, your take on that Social Security number. How critical was that?
Well, initially, it was great because it gave through that database that Sheila ran, Merlin, gave us that P.O. box.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't have a clue that it belonged to a different name, but it was fundamental. It was key. And even though he's changed it since on his motor vehicle records, it still led us to the address. So there you have it.
So if Congress attempted to block your continued access to Social Security information, would you say that Clarence Pellett's case might be significant? And
It would probably still be ongoing.
Yeah, well,
especially
we just got other.
Especially, Tom, that this was given to them by the family. Okay, this is not something that you digged up. The family said, "Here's his Social Security number." You know.
Yeah.
You know, Tom.
Yeah.
Related to that too is the information that Pat used with forwarding. That was something PIs lost years ago, and NCISS and investigators collectively were able to get that back for limited purpose, which, you know, gave Pat the ability to use that. So it's important for our audience to know that although we have access to this information, there are people that don't want us to have access, and then we use it for things like this and for other things, collecting child support, judgments, even finding just witnesses and stuff, but also finding, you know, people that have committed brutal murders and escaped for 40 years. And I know that's how you met Dr. Pellett, and I know Pat's part of, and Sheila and everybody are part of the same group that are fighting to keep this legislation. So I think our audience needs to know just how important these little things are. If it wasn't for those little things, this case would, you know, he probably would die a natural death without anybody knowing any different.
Well, and you know, from a lay person standpoint, I mean, I just can't tell you how grateful I am to the PI profession. I mean, it's changed my life for the good forever.
Yeah, it has.
And,
yeah.
And a lot of people's lives. And, you know, geez, it was a 60-year-old murder case. I mean, the police, you know, they have other things to do. And so if a family member picks up on this and decides to do it on their own and they don't have access to this information, you know, that's it wouldn't have been solved. So I'm most grateful and will be forever grateful for it.
Yeah, this was a cold case solved by good old gumshoe work, not necessarily DNA. Good old gumshoe work.
Clem, have you begun thinking about doing a book?
Well, you know, we're trying. I have a writer. We have a working title. It's called Dastardly. We're shopping it around New York right now, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed. With the economy and just the basic changes in the publishers' business, we'll just have to wait and see. But over this time period that I just kept working on this, and my wife calls me obsessive, but I just like to say persistent. But I could be just as persistent with this. So I'm going to certainly keep trying and keep people's shoulders to the wheel on this.
I see a couple of great themes. One, that a family that was torn apart by a tragedy came full circle. Another theme of dogged, committed private investigators accomplishing some really good work. And third, justice for Clarence Pellett.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I just didn't know of my grandfather, and now I know of his personality, and I get to talk to Dorothy and my other cousins, and you just find out stories, and it's anyway, you just feel kind of more complete. It's I think there's some good themes. That's certainly how we're going.
Vito, any suggestions?
No, I mean, what's great about this book, and Tom, I got my second book coming out at the beginning of April, but what's great about this book is you're dealing with 1951, 1969, you're into the 2000s, and there's interesting things that are happening all the time. And just the whole hook of this is that the grandson, the grandson goes out there, starts to put this all together, gets the PIs that do a yeoman's job. You have everybody all of a sudden clicking on these type of cases, and it's definitely, I know from my own radio show that the interest in crime-type stories is amazing out there. Even with this economy, the people still buy and they still love to read an interesting case like this. I mean, I really enjoyed it when I read up on this one. I said, wow, this one's really good to talk about.
Clemens, 48 Hours ever reached out to you?
Yeah, 48 Hours, Dateline. We finally did do a show. It was on A&E Biography Channel. It was by Partners in Motion, and the show, if they want to look it up, is it's out of Canada, and the show, it's an hour long show, and it's called The Kid with the Hollywood Haircut.
It's very well done.
Yeah, it's very well done. And
where can our listeners across the country find the link to that?
It's called Partners in Motion. Partners in Motion, and that will bring you that. And then under the search engine or the search window, just type in the kid with the Hollywood haircut.
All right. All right. And maybe in the near future we will be watching this on the big screen. This is an incredible story.
Well,
I wish you all the best with getting it going. And again, Vito's an accomplished author, as well as Dean has written a couple of books as well. So here are a couple of resources that you can lean on.
They'll probably hear from me tomorrow.
And I'm going to work with Pat and Sheila on a couple of things we'd actually talked about in Vegas. Look forward to that.
Yeah, I hope so. It's the other activities are there to be. It's not low hanging fruit, but it's there to be picked, I think.
Clem, have you done any forensic work in your capacity as a oral surgeon?
Oh, that's a good question. No, I haven't. But as time goes along, and I get to meet, I can't tell you how many PIs I've met, but it's a very nice bunch of people. They're very friendly, lots of integrity. You never know, I might join the ranks. Who knows?
Well, the PI, you know, the PI associations have changed so much. The PIs themselves have changed so much from back in the days where many, a lot of people didn't respect them. A lot of cops didn't respect them. They were always accused of doing things illegally, you know, private property issues, all kinds of different issues. And now the associations, at least that I belong to, make sure that that doesn't happen anymore, because we don't want men or women in our business that are going to bring a bad name to all of the good work we do. Because that's when you get the dirty looks and everything else, because they connect you to the Perner Carroll, whatever his name was, in California, that was doing all the things for the all the stars there and other people across the country. Another one was just arrested in New Jersey for doing illegal things. And those are the people you do not want in our business, because that every time that goes on the front page of a paper, it's going to hurt each one of us on this show tonight in one way or another.
Something we can ill afford.
Right.
Dorothy, any final thoughts here before we begin to wrap it up?
Just that it was a tragedy, but 60 years later, a family reunited, and that's absolutely amazing. And we've seen them several times, and my kids love them. It's just that's the best part of this, that Clem pursued it, and a fractured family was reunited forever. So,
here, here.
Pat Shaughnessy?
And such a fine family it is, too. Clem is just one of the all-time great people to work with and for. It was such a wonderful opportunity. And there's still a couple of unsolved crimes out there that we think are connected to this man. And we would dearly like to satisfy those, you know, those two pieces of justice as well. And we're still on it. We're not done. He may have to account for two more bodies.
Well, you be sure to let us know of any significant update, and we'll have you back on the show.
Surely. It's been a pleasure. Yeah,
keep in touch. And keep in touch either via all of our websites. If people are involved in Facebook, friend each other, and just whatever way that we can stay connected and help each other in this business.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank Dean, you. Final thoughts?
Yeah, almost exactly what Pat and Vito said. And, you know, there's some things to be answered for other families. I think it's great that Dr. Pellett's family was able to, come together and heal. And hopefully we can kind of bring some resolution to a couple other cold cases out of all this.
Yes, thank you.
That sounds like an
hey, Tom.
Case. Okay.
Tom,
go ahead.
You said told me earlier today you were going to ask Dr. Clem if you can get a quick root canal before the show's over. Are you here for that?
A virtual one.
Hey, I'll tell you.
A virtual one. Yeah.
It would be my pleasure.
Well.
Tom, you're at a loss for words, Tom. You
yeah, yeah. Got me good there. Clem, I'll let you in the next 30, 40 seconds here before we have to conclude. Your final thoughts.
Well, obviously I'm going to echo a lot of everybody else's thoughts, but this is probably the extraordinary experience of my life other than marrying my wife and seeing the birth of my daughter. But this has just been unbelievable, and as Dorothy said, ongoing. I mean, we're whole again. I never had an extended family, but now I have a huge one. So I'm just most grateful to the private investigators.
All right. I'll turn it over to Vito.
Okay. Thanks to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be Tuesday, November 22nd. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
All right.
Good night.
All right.